Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer on WNYC and New Jersey Public Radio. Good morning. Before you buckled down for your Thanksgiving meal last week, you likely saw images of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton meeting with Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi in Cairo. They had worked together on negotiations to end the violence between Hamas and Israel. They were smiling. Morsi's government was widely praised for working on the ceasefire deal. And when you woke up from your turkey coma on Friday, President Morsi had announced he was above the oversight of any Egyptian court, and he had granted himself broad, unchecked authority. Protesters took to the streets in Tahrir Square and elsewhere around the country, and Morsi's political offices were attacked. With us now to explain what this means for U.S. diplomacy in the region is David Sanger. He's chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and a WNYC contributor. Welcome back, David, to WNYC.
Great to be with you, Amy.
How's your Thanksgiving?
Very nice, very nice.
That's good to hear. So Morsi's announcement came late Thanksgiving Day when we were all tucking into an extra plate of dessert, just after Secretary Clinton had left Cairo. He tried to justify his expanded powers by saying he was protecting Egypt's revolution. Take us through those expanded powers and his reasoning.
Well, his expanded powers seem to come down to one big one, Amy, which is that he's not going to allow the courts to review any of his actions and say that he is taking action simply to continue the revolution that, of course, began in early January 2011. The protests that you mentioned have forced a little bit of a backtracking, as he has seen people in the streets, as his own justice minister and other ministers have raised some objections. He's begun to say, well, I didn't mean this would be permanent. I meant it would be temporary. But he didn't say what temporary meant. Now, what problem does this pose for the United States? It basically puts President Obama back in the situation that many of his predecessors, most recently George W. Bush, found themselves in, which is they need Egypt and they need the leader of Egypt to back the peace accord with Israel, which is quite critical. And because Morsi is, of course, came out of the Muslim Brotherhood side of the Egyptian political movement, which for years was jailed and repressed, he's got particular street credibility with Hamas. And they needed him as they needed him last week to get the ceasefire done. The downside is that in order to get all those things done, they may have to ignore some of what he's done at home. Mm. And so they issued a very careful statement out of the State Department on Thanksgiving or the day after, I guess it came out on Friday, expressing concern about what President Morsi had done, but never even mentioning his name.
Right. So here we are with some unlikely bedfellows in our larger goals in the United States as the United States plays peacemaker in the region. So if Morsi's,
yes, but exactly the same problem that we had for 30 years
right,
with President
with
Mubarak.
Exactly.
Yeah. The more it changes, the more it doesn't.
So if Morsi cemented himself as a negotiator and diplomat in the region last week, what happens now with Israel and Hamas? How has Israel taken to the U.S.'s view of Morsi's power grab?
Well, Israel has said almost nothing about it because Israel tends to view these things through the prism of who's going to keep peace with Israel and what is Morsi going to do about controlling movements across the Egyptian border with the Gaza and the Egyptian-Israeli border. And so far, Morsi has been much better on that issue than many people had expected. Remember, when he came into office just a few months ago, there was significant question about whether or not he would abandon the peace treaty. There was question about whether he would actually try to keep the border fairly well controlled, which the Egyptian military certainly wants to do to avoid having instability roll into the Sinai area. So Israel has been very quiet about the internals. But remember, the Israelis were highly critical of President Obama for, in their view, letting President Mubarak leave office. The argument you heard in Israel was that President Obama threw Mubarak under the bus. Hmm. Now, as I viewed this here in Washington, covering it at the time, that wasn't my sense. My sense was that it was Mubarak who threw Mubarak under the bus. The president let the bus roll back and forth over him a few times.
We definitely have some time for calls from our listeners with ties to Egypt. I'm Amy Edding, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and I'm speaking with the New York Times' David Sanger about President Morsi's power grab after helping to negotiate a ceasefire with the United States between Gaza and Israel. What are you hearing from family and friends in Egypt about Morsi's move? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. What did you think last week about how he handled the Israel-Gaza negotiations? Our phone lines are open for our Egyptian listeners now. 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. David Sanger, what do you think it meant that Morsi announced this expansion of his authority just after getting so much praise for his work on the Gaza-Israel deal?
Well, he probably figured, I mean, who knows how related they were in his mind, and he may have been driven more by domestic issues, but my suspicion is that he figured that he had the United States exactly where he needed mm-hmm. them, which is to say they needed him suddenly more than he needed the U.S. Remember, when he came in, the question that the U.S. was asking was, you know, how are you going to behave? Because it's entirely possible we might have to turn off some of that $1.3 billion in military aid. And then, of course, there's an additional smaller amounts of non-military aid. Now the question for Morsi is, so tell us, what is it that we may have to, what agreements may we have to come to if you want my continued support in intervening with Hamas?
Do you have any sense of whether the U.S. saw this coming from Morsi?
I certainly have no indication that they saw it coming from him. They were worried when he first came in that he would be extremely weak, that the military would sort of run circles around him. Now I think their biggest concern about him is that he may be too strong.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think the U.S. position, though, as it seems to be evolving, is there's no percentage in Washington getting in the middle of this, that this is one of those things you go through as you're coming out of a revolutionary situation, that there's certainly opposition to Morsi seizing these kind of powers. You saw people who had supported the revolution come out into Tahrir Square. You saw them come out in Alexandria. You saw some attacks on Muslim Brotherhood offices in Egypt. And so I think the U.S. position at this point is there's nothing to be gained from the U.S. getting in the middle of it and see whether or not the natural system of checks and balances is more effective.
Senator John McCain was on Fox News Sunday yesterday. He was asked if Egypt is headed toward a new Islamist coup. Here he is.
I think it could be headed that way. You could also be headed back to a military takeover if things went in the wrong direction. You could also see a scenario where there's continued chaos.
Are any of those threats real in your mind, David Sanger, and would that change the U.S.'s current laissez-faire approach?
Well, they could all be true, but I'm not sure. You know, there's a difference between a laissez-faire approach and an approach in which you recognize that you don't have a whole lot of leverage. And, you know, the history of the U.S. and before that Britain in Egypt is that every time that we intervene, we create a set of resentments that go off in unpredictable ways. And I think that, you know, there's always a great hue and cry in the U.S. to say, so what are you going to do about this?
Right.
And sometimes the answer to that, which is never one that's a good one for politicians to go utter in public, is there isn't much we can do about this
for a while. Not a whole heck of a lot, right.
Right. For example, that $1.3 billion in aid, its origin, its political origin, was that it was sort of the payment for sustaining the Israel-Egypt peace treaty, the first big peace treaty in the Mideast after, of course, several wars. So if the U.S. pulled that, it would make it all that much easier for the Egyptians to say, well, fine, we'll pull our side of the bargain. So, you know, you never want to quite overestimate your leverage.
I'm speaking with David Sanger from the New York Times. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and we're taking your calls on President Morsi's power grab. Steve in Manhattan, you're on WNYC.
Yeah,
good morning,
no,
Steve.
I object to this whole power grab terminology. The situation there has been where you've got the courts, which were appointed, I think, by Mubarak and the military there, abrogating an entire parliamentary election. You still have these elements there, and I think this guy's trying to bring this revolution into for a soft landing. I just think it's way too soon to assume that he's, you know, a new Hugo Chavez, or a new Mubarak or a new Pharaoh. I mean, just listen to what he says. He says this is like, I'm not going to have the courts frustrate this revolution, and I'm going to stand by it while this constituent assembly is writing the Constitution. Can David tell us how that process is going, and when this Constitution is going to be presented, and how that will be ratified, and what happens? I suppose it depends on what's in the Constitution, but I think 95% of it is pretty well done.
Steve, thank you for that.
What's going to happen next?
Sure. Thanks, Steve, for your call. David, you want to...
Sure. No, Steve raises a very good question, and in fact, we don't know how this is going to play out over the long term, which may be another reason for a little bit of caution in how the U.S. Reacts to this. And he's absolutely right that much of this depends on how the Constitution is written. Now, the Constitution was supposed to be completed some time ago. It was actually supposed to be completed first end of last year, and then beginning of this year, there was a parliamentary election that took place in January. I was in Egypt for that, and that parliament sat briefly, and then big elements of the election were invalidated. And that whole process and crisis of just trying to come up with a legitimate parliament has greatly slowed the Constitution writing. Now, there were many who thought you needed to have a Constitution before you had a parliament. I think they came to the conclusion they couldn't wait that long. So, you know, it's been a very messy process. But I remind people that while, you know, we revere our own Constitution, it was a messy process getting to that as well. You know, we had first nothing, then the Articles of Confederation, then that began to fall apart into what we now consider to be the Constitution. So it was, you know, a good number of years after the American Revolution was complete, 7 or 8 years before we really got our act together on this.
David Sanger of the New York Times. He's chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Thanks so much for joining us once again, David.
Thank you, Amy. Great to be with you.
And again, the conversation continues on the Brian Lehrer Show page online at WNYC.org. Coming up next, we will hear about other things happening on Capitol Hill that don't have to do with the fiscal cliff. We check in on what's going on with the Farm Bill. Stay tuned.